Okay. So, as I was telling the people who are here at the beginning, the particle physics group is actually having an LHC day today where we're going over recent results. And so, it starts right after the class. So if anyone's really interested in hearing about what the LHC is doing, they're welcome to come along. It's going to be in the gravity room, I think. Okay, so yesterday we finished talking about direct detection, and what we found were that there were these two qualitatively different kinds of scattering. There were scattering that was independent of the spin of the nucleus, so this is nucleus spin independent, and the cross-section scaled like the total number of nucleons in the nucleus. This is what you got from scalar and vector kinds of interactions, and these were very constrained by direct detection experiments because of this large A squared enhancement. However, if you consider things that are spin dependent, where the cross section goes like essentially the spin of the nucleus squared, this is an order one number instead of an order 10 to the four number. And so the bounds are constantly weaker, so these scenarios are less constrained. And in fact, as we'll show in the tutorial today, this last interaction here, which is a pseudoscalar, it has an additional velocity suppression factor. So it's not only smaller by a factor of j squared over a squared, but it's a factor also smaller by a factor of v squared over the mass v squared. So direct detection is really good at probing certain kinds of interactions that give us the dark matter thermorelic abundance, but there are other kinds of interactions that it just basically you won't see them in your detector. And it's even a little bit worse than this because these are ruled out under certain assumptions. So in particular, they're mostly ruled out if your dark matter interacts predominantly with light flavor quarks. So for instance, if I have dark matter annihilating through some interaction to up up down, there are a lot of up and down up and sorry up up bar. There are a lot of up and down quarks in the proton, and so this thing is ruled out. But you could imagine scenarios where, say, instead of only interacting with up up down, I interact with say TT bar, BB bar, etc. So an example of this would be the Higgs. We know that the Higgs interactions with fermions, the Yukawa coupling scales like the mass of the fermion over the VEV of the Higgs. So a Higgs is going to interact much more strongly with heavy stuff than with light stuff. And so even these very strong constraints can be weakened somewhat if you consider that there's some weird flavor structure associated with your dark matter scattering. So, now, the spin-dependent bounds are getting so strong that these are starting to be ruled out as well, okay? Just from the fact that you can kind of close a loop here and still scatter off of a, say, a proton, okay? So for a while, you could dodge the constraints of moving to something like this. It's becoming less tenable to do so. But the point is that direct detection does not completely probe all of the possible interactions that give us a dark matter thermal abundance. And so this is really just sort of one tool that we have in our toolbox in order to understand it. So you can then ask, well, what else can I do to look for it? The other thing that I should point out is that remember in our definition of the rate as a differential rate with respect to the recoil energy, this was also proportional to some integral over the velocity distribution times the velocity. So direct detection also suffers from the fact that we're constrained to measure things on the Earth or a little bit under the Earth, and we don't really know what this dark matter density is here. Okay, so all of these things put together, you can cook up some models that evade all of the constraints that we talked about. So we wanted something that's very complementary to this. And it turns out that there are ways of doing this such that the easiest things to look for in direct detection experiments are hard to look for in the other experiments, but the things that are hard to look for in direct detection experiments are easier to look for in those experiments. So they complement each other quite nicely. So before I move on to the next topic, are there any questions just remaining about the direct detection stuff that we talked about? Okay. So for direct detection, we looked at dark matter coming in, and it's scattered off of a nucleus. now what we're going to consider are searches that directly look for the dark matter annihilation process. That sets the dark matter abundance. But remember, we had this dark matter annihilation into some standard model fields. This was what determined the amount of dark matter you have. And so we say, well, astrophysically, there are these big clumps of dark matter. And so if dark matter annihilates today, it will annihilate through the exact same interaction. And so what I can do is look for that. So I'm directly probing this interaction. We call it indirect detection because I'm not seeing dark matter. So in a direct detection experiment, I'm actually seeing dark matter come and collide with something. For indirect detection, what I'm looking for are these standard model particles that are the products of dark matter annihilation. Okay? So there are a few questions that we can have about this. Whoops. So one is, didn't dark matter stop annihilating, right? So the whole point of the relic abundance was that at a certain point, T freeze out, dark matter became so dilute and the universe was expanding so quickly that it just doesn't find each other to annihilate. And the answer to this is yes, but there we were really talking about on cosmological scales. So dark matter has stopped annihilating so that its annihilation doesn't appreciably change its number density today. But a lot has changed since that early universe where we had a very uniform density and dark matter was very evenly distributed. Now, dark matter has formed into these halos which are much denser than dark matter was at those particular points in time. So it stopped annihilating on cosmological scales, but it's now in clumps and it can start annihilating again. So it leads to annihilation. And once again, this annihilation is not sufficient to appreciably change its number density, but it is happening. And so we can say, can we actually go and look for this? Okay. And what's nice about this is that we can see the clumps. The fact that these clumps of dark matter were there constituted a large part of the body of evidence for what dark matter was, that there was dark matter, that there's this stuff that's gravitating that we can't see. So the question is, okay, we can maybe see it a little bit in these particles, and so we can look at where we think there's a lot of dark matter and look for some faint trace of the products of dark matter annihilation. Okay? So then the second question is, how do we know that the products are from dark matter? Whoops. And the answer to this question is, on a certain level, we don't necessarily. So astrophysics is a very complicated thing. There are a lot of different kinds of astrophysical objects. And in particular, there are a lot of different kinds of weird astrophysical objects. So for instance, there are these things called pulsars, which are these rapidly rotating stars that can accelerate cosmic rays and smash them into things. And they can give you very energetic particles. Likewise, dark matter annihilation, these are two, if it's a WIMP dark matter, two very heavy objects that annihilate into very fast-moving particles. And so these two things can kind of get mixed up. So the problem is that we can't actually go... Yes, Karen?
How do we know that there's an appreciable number of both dark matter and anti-dark matter? How do we know there isn't an asymmetry like there is in the barium spectrum?
So that's a very good question. We don't, okay? And that's actually one of the principal ways of evading indirect detection constraints, is to say that that we actually have more of chi than chi bar. So the one comment I would make about that is that then your dark matter annihilation is not setting your relic abundance. Okay, your relic abundance is set by the asymmetry. And so then you have to consider both what's causing your asymmetry, and also you actually need to have an annihilation rate that's larger than the thermal annihilation rate, because you actually need to deplete all of the antiparticles away. And so we'll talk about this probably at the end of next week if we have time. But the best hopes of seeing those theories are you have to put in some very strong interaction that interacts with dark matter. And so you try to see that instead of seeing this. But it's a very good question. And as with all of the dark matter stuff, because we don't really know what's going on in the sector, there's always a bunch of assumptions that go into the constraints that we put. As we'll see, there are ways for this annihilation to not happen, even if that's if there are lots of chi's and chi bars. So just like there was a velocity suppression for direct detection, there's also a velocity suppression for certain operators for indirect detection. OK, so the point is we don't necessarily know that the products are from dark matter. But what we can do is we can look at different regions of high dark matter density. And then we can try to correlate signatures in these regions of high dark matter density. And the amount of visible matter that you have in those regions might be different. And so the hope is that even though we can't, you know, travel to the center of the galaxy and actually, you know, put out a probe and look for dark matter, we can try and look for dark matter in enough different places and for enough distinctive signatures of the dark matter annihilation that we can't mistake it for an astrophysical process. But there have been a lot of potential signatures of dark matter annihilation in indirect detection experiments, and nearly all of them have turned out to be either an instrumental effect or an astrophysical effect. So this is a challenging way of looking for dark matter. But in some ways, it's complementary to the direct detection in that we're looking where we know that there's dark matter. And so if this is happening, we should be able to see it at some level, or we should at least be able to make a quantitative statement. Whereas for direct detection, we're a little bit more subject to, oh, I simulated this, and this is what my simulation told me would happen. You also have some dependence on this as well, but I would argue that it's a little bit less, probably. Okay, so what we're looking for is annihilation of particular regions. Okay, so the overview of the topic. First, we're going to talk about dark matter halos again. So before, we talked about dark matter halos in that we cared about what dark matter was doing here at our radius. Now we care about what's happening on very large scales. Okay, so on the galactic scale, where is dark matter? On extragalactic scales, where is dark matter? Then we'll talk a little bit about the formalism for indirect detection. Now, mercifully, this is much, much simpler. We saw that this was sort of the hardest thing to do about direct detection because we had to map our interactions onto the nuclear interactions. Fortunately, our initial states here are just dark matter. There's no QCD stuff. And so basically, just normal particle physics cross-sections are going to enter into our expression for rates. So that will save us a lot of trouble. And then we're specifically going to talk about dark matter annihilation to gamma rays. Okay, so dark matter we don't know what the theory is, so in principle we want to look for dark matter annihilating to all possible standard model states. I'll explain to you why I'm going to talk about gamma rays, but the answer is that gamma rays are neutral, and so they're just photons. And so dark matter annihilates, and the photons come straight from wherever it is to us. They don't interact with anything. And so in that sense, they're sort of the purest probe. You can also use other particles, but charged particles get bent in the magnetic fields of the galaxy. They get kicked by scatterings off of photons and other things. And so there's sort of more of a haze between the like particle physics process that's going on in say the center of the galaxy and what we actually observe. And that's a complexity that isn't really related to the fundamental physics. So I'll just sort of skip over all of that and consider something where we don't have to think about it. But if you're particularly interested in individual cosmic rays, then this is something that you could, for instance, do for your final presentation. Okay, and then we'll talk about some other implications of dark matter annihilation. Okay. So let's start with talking about halos. So where is dark matter? There are two places that are reasonable places to look in particular. So there's the galactic center of the Milky Way. So we know that that dark matter concentrates in the center of galaxies. We know that from the rotation curves of other galaxies that we look at. We know that dark matter provides sort of the seed gravitational potential that causes structure formation. And to get a detailed understanding of this, we still have to rely on n-body simulations of dark matter formation. And so what you end up with, we've seen some of this cartoon before, but for galaxies that are like ours, you end up with a disk of visible matter. So this is where pretty much all of the stars and everything are concentrated, and we're located on this disk. So here's the galactic center, here's us, at about 8.5 kiloparsecs from the center. And then there's maybe a little bit of a bulge here in visible matter. And then there was this large spherical halo of dark matter. And we know that it has to be spherical from the rotation curves. You know, you have these relations that connect Poisson's equation to the rotational velocity. So it's a spherically symmetric dark matter halo, but it's spherically symmetric, and as you would expect, it's dense in the middle. So it's dense in the center region. So, I mean, it's not surprising, but the area of the highest concentration of visible matter, which is right in this bulge in the center of the galaxy, is exactly where there's a lot of dark matter. Okay. So what is the radial profile? So this is also something that we get from n-body simulations, but so these are things that we get from n-body simulations, but we can also look at other galaxies and infer their distributions from their rotation curves. So this is sort of some, it's a little bit more checked, say, for n-body simulations. Yes, Kira.
How does it stay as a sphere? Is it rotating with the galaxy?
No, it's at rest of the galaxy, yeah. So there's an individual dark matter particle has this typical velocity of 220 kilometers per second, but on the whole, so this is the average. So it just stays there. Okay. Okay. So the radial profile can be parameterized by some kind of fit function, and we talked about in the first lecture that actually n-body simulations don't quite reproduce it. The n-body simulations tend to give what we call cusp profiles, where there's a very steep dark matter profile in the center, whereas observations of other galaxies tend to give more chord profiles. So this will have an effect on the bounds that we set from indirect detection, because it sort of matters how steep the profile is, but you can account for that by tweaking what profile you're using. So often what people will do when they're setting bounds is they'll show results for like three different values of the fit function. One is going to be a cuspier one, one is going to be a more chord one. So this is something that we have some systematic control over. We kind of know what the maximal difference between the n-body simulations and what we observe are. So an example of this, which is a very common one, is called the Navarro-Frank-White profile, or NFW. There are others, there's iNASTO, and there's some kind of core or something, I can't remember exactly what it's called. Okay, so we have rho of r. So this is the mass, or I guess it's a number density. You can also express it in terms of mass density. It's a number density as a function of radius from the center of the galaxy. And you can parameterize it by this. So R sub s and gamma are the parameters that you're fitting for. And what the NFW profile does is you see that in the limit where R over R sub s is small versus large, it actually scales like a different power of the radius R. So this allows you to put in both cuspier and more chord profiles where, you know, if you have sort of one power law and then it switches to a different power law, this would happen in this thing around this R sub s. Okay. So the typical values that they use are R sub s is about 20 kiloparsecs for a galaxy of R size, and gamma sort of between 1 and 2. Okay, but like I said, what people usually do is make explicit assumptions about what this is, and then they pick different values of different profiles and compare what you get for the results. Okay, so this clearly blows up as we go to R goes to zero. So this is exactly where we want to be living. So The advantages are lots of dark matter. So we should see lots of signal of dark matter annihilation. The disadvantages are lots of everything else. So there's a lot that we don't understand about the galactic center. There's actually a lot that we don't understand about this whole region. So for instance, there are these regions sort of just off the plane of the galaxy that extend about 50 degrees off the axis of the center, which have sort of these anomalously bright gamma ray emissions. These are called the Fermi bubbles. And they don't necessarily seem connected to dark matter annihilation. So there are some sort of crazy things that happen in the galactic center. But you also have a lot of dark matter. So the hope is that even though there's all of this emission, the standard model emission tends to be at lower energies. A dark matter particle of 1 GeV or 100 GeV annihilating is going to produce particles that are of order hundreds of GeV. The galactic center doesn't produce a lot of those. So it's still a good place to look, even if we don't really quite have good control over everything that's going on. So typically when people set bounds, they try to be very conservative. Or, you know, when they're looking for dark matter, you try to absorb the fact that we don't know overall what the emission in different energy bins is like, and so you kind of do various fits that account for this. Okay. So the second place that we might want to look is somewhere where it's you end up with. They're places where they're kind of the opposite of the galactic center from the perspective of the advantages and disadvantages. Okay, so these are called dwarf spheroidal galaxies. And what dwarf spheroidal galaxies are is they're basically little galaxies that hang around the periphery of the Milky Way. So they're sort of companion galaxies, which are small and quite dim. So they're companions. Of the Milky Way. But what's nice about them is that they're dark matter dominated galaxies. So in the center of the Milky Way, there are just so many baryons concentrated there that the dynamics of the inner galaxy are driven by the baryons, not by the dark matter, even though there also happens to be a lot of dark matter there. For dwarfs, they're basically little clumps of matter that they attract some visible matter, but there's always more dark matter than visible matter. So these have sort of the opposite advantages and disadvantages. So the advantages are very low astrophysical backgrounds. Because basically you take the relative amounts of whatever astrophysical backgrounds are going on in the galactic center and you crank up the dark matter signal and you turn down the standard model background, so the astrophysical background. The disadvantage of this, of course, is that there's a low signal rate. So here you're really dominated by statistics, like how many of those cosmic rays can I see because there's relatively little dark matter, but if I see it, I tend to believe it more. Whereas in the galactic center, I tend to be dominated by my systematic uncertainties. I get a ton of photons coming at me, and I think some of them are dark matter, but the certainty with which I can ascribe them to, say, a dark matter annihilation versus astrophysics is worse. So the ideal thing is that you would like to observe any potential signature in both of these places, and if they're consistent with one another, then that's telling you that probably it's not your astrophysical model that's doing it, because it would have to be a really weird astrophysical model that affects both the center of the galaxy and dwarfs. Okay? All right. So the general strategy of indirect detection experiments is we're going to take a telescope and then we're going to point it at one of these places. And then we're just going to look for these high energy cosmic rays that are the result of dark matter annihilation. So it's a pretty simple idea. And so the question is, the challenges are all in the details of disentangling the astrophysics. Okay. There are also other possibilities. So, you know, you can try to look for dark matter annihilating more diffusely, you can look for at it annihilating in other galaxy clusters. There are other things that you can do, but these are the most sensitive for most of the things that we're interested in, and particularly in the energy range for WIMP dark matter. All right, so are there any questions about this part? Yes, Kira. That's a good question. So we'll get to that when we actually talk a little bit more about the particular annihilation. So naively, if I have a particle of m chi annihilating to something, just conservation of energy tells me that this is also going to have m chi energy, and this is also going to be m chi of energy. So if we're broadening our definition of WIMP to include things down to few GeV, this is in the few GeV to TeV range. Okay, so this is what it looks like immediately after the collision. That's just conservation of energy. Then you get into the questions that I was saying where, well, if it's a cosmic ray and it bounces off of something else, then it can lose some of its energy. Okay, so we'll see that for photons, you end up with both very high energy photons, which are in this few hundred GeV range, and you also end up with lower energy photons that form like a continuum spectrum. So just like you ideally would want to see evidence for dark matter annihilation in different spatial locations, you would also probably want to see the various correlated energy energies associated with the cosmic rays. You'd want to see the very high energy ones, and you'd want to see the low energy kind of rescattered products, and you want them all to be consistent with one another.
And those would be gamma rays?
Yeah, so these are all gamma. So they can be gamma rays. You can also look for... Things that people look for include gamma rays, positrons, antiprotons, antideuterons. I mean, so you can see a little bit of a pattern here. We like looking for things that are anti-stuff just because they're a lot rarer. And if you have chi-chi bar going to FF bar, you're producing equal quantities of matter and antimatter. So this immediately cuts off a bunch of our astrophysical uncertainties. So, but again, all of these things are charged. So you have to worry about not just their production, but then also how they propagate through the galaxy to us. That's right. So it's Fermi, there's Hess. So there's an experiment called AMS, which doesn't look for gamma rays, it looks for charged particles. So basically, they are like little mini particle physics experiments in space. So for instance, the way Fermi works is they have a bunch of layers of material that a photon comes through, and then they interact electromagnetically, and they produce a shower of charged particles, just like a photon in the LHC would do. And then they can infer the direction of the photon, and they use various spatial qualities of the shower in order to determine sort of how well they can measure its properties. So, but yeah, they're sort of like mini particle physics experiments. They're very cool machines. So,
would you use things like the Pierre-Auger?
So you can use things like that. You can also use, Fermi can infer something about the relative numbers of positrons and electrons. So they don't have a magnetic field, so what they actually do to distinguish electrons and positrons, they use the magnetic field of the Earth, which is kind of incredible. Their answers turned out to be kind of wrong. Like, they were qualitatively correct, but there's clearly some offset that they had in their data where they hadn't correctly calibrated something, because there was this interesting signature where they had sort of the fraction of positrons to electrons, and at a certain energy of order a few times of GeV, the number density falls and then it goes back up again. And for a while, people thought this was dark matter annihilation, although now people are more inclined to believe that it's just some astrophysics. But Fermi was sort of almost correct, where they were sort of up here a bit. But it's really incredible that this experiment that is not meant to look for cosmic rays could look for cosmic rays. But there's also an experiment called AMS-2, which is basically a calorimeter that they shot into space. It has tracking, it has all of these things. So. That's also somewhat miraculous that it works, to be honest. It was quite a far behind schedule, so I think people were skeptical that it would actually happen. So, any other questions about sort of the basics that we're talking about?
If the dark matter is interacting weakly, you probably wouldn't see the huge number that's in the probability. Basically, how likely is it that those would even be able to?
So there's a high. So the problem is that they will reach us, but they won't necessarily be coming from the center of the galaxy if they're a charged particle, because they get sort of spun around. So there are enough of them floating around, because really what you're doing is you're, for charged particles, you're just injecting high energy charged particles into the sort of mess of stuff that's going on in the middle, and then some of them get spat out. So you're not actually seeing directly the annihilation, but you can look for the effects of the fact that there's this source pumping high energy, say anti-protons or positrons into it. For the gamma rays, it's much easier. And again, there's a lot of dark matter in there. So even if this interacts quite weakly, you see a substantial amount of it. I mean, it's hard astrophysically to have 100 GeV energies ever. I mean, the only way we're able to do that is at like the tetrahedron or the LHC. So they're pretty distinctive, but you know, the relative rates are something to worry about. Okay. Ross.
You made it sound like this excess went away, but AMS also sees the positron excess, right? You're just saying.
Yeah. So the excess is still there. So they still see this rising spectrum. AMS agrees very well with it, but there are various reasons why this may not be dark matter, just because in order to produce this much of an effect, the annihilation cross-section has to be like 100 to 1,000 times bigger than the relic abundance cross-section. And I think people are beginning to question more the astrophysical origins behind this. And so Kaffir Bloom gave a talk here last year. I don't know if you were there for that, but he showed that, so he and his collaborator showed that it is reasonable to expect that, for instance, the magnetic fields and various sources could give rise to a rising fraction. Basically, things at lower energy get bent too much and they get sort of trapped, but things at higher energy got spat out. And so it looks like you're seeing more particles at higher energy, but it's really just they're able to reach us better. So now, if you were to see something like this, where there's lots of rays that go up and then they suddenly fall off, this is a very clear signature of dark matter annihilation, because this process, the energy is strictly less than M chi. Okay? And so if you have this very sharp cutoff, then that's a clear signature of dark matter annihilation. Of course, AMS sort of stops showing their data here. And it's kind of controversial, because they should have data that goes up into higher bins, and they've been adamantly refusing to show it, which has, of course, given rise to a lot of speculation. But you know, you can think. If you can decide for yourself whether you want to get into that. So, okay. Okay, so let's look at what the formalism is. So what you do is you take your telescope and you pick a direction, which we'll call n hat. And when I point my telescope in that direction, what I'm really seeing is all of the light or cosmic rays or whatever I'm looking for integrated from here out to infinity. Okay. Anything that's annihilating in this direction, that, you know, assuming that I take into account the diffusion and scattering, all this kind of thing, I'm sensitive to all of that. Okay, so this is what we call a line of sight integral. We don't have any sense of how far away things are. Now, this is in contrast with some astrophysical measurements. So for instance, if we're looking at hydrogen gas, if things are farther away, they're moving away from us faster, they're redshifting more, and so we can make some inference about the distance. But we don't really know what energy range we're looking for, so we can't do that. So we really have no sense of how far away things are coming from. But if I take my telescope and point at the center of the galaxy, almost everything that comes to me is stuff that came from the center of the galaxy. It's so bright that these line of sight integrals are typically dominated by whatever source you're pointed at. And so what we do is we define a flux. So that it's a rate per unit area, per unit energy. And this is pointing in a particular direction. Remember, direction n hat. So we define this as phi I. So this depends on the energy of the particle and n hat. And it's basically just the annihilation cross-section over 8 pi times the mass of the dark matter squared times this function f, which I'll define in a second. And then I do this line of sight integral, where I integrate out from me to infinity of the dark matter density squared along this line. So So what f is the fraction of an I, the fraction of particles I with energy E coming from dark matter annihilation. So if I compute my dark matter annihilation cross-section, I can write as a differential cross-section an energy. And you know, there's some distribution of the energies of the particles. And so this is energy. This is Fi of energy. And this spectrum is going to be related to M chi and whatever, you know, kinematics of my scattering. This just accounts for the fact that scattering typically doesn't give me one particular energy, it gives me lots of energies. And so what I want at each energy is to just pick up the fraction of the annihilations that populate that. Okay? Now, this rho squared over m squared, rho over m is just the number density. So what I'm really doing is I'm saying, well, in order to annihilate, I need to have two dark matter particles colliding with each other. And so my annihilation rate is going to be proportional to the number of dark matter squared. And then I just multiply that by my annihilation cross-section times velocity, and that tells me what the flux of dark matter is relative to itself, and that just immediately tells me what my rate is. Okay? So just like for direct detection, we can divide this up. This is astrophysics, essentially. All of my uncertainty about where my dark matter is located is completely determined by, you know, how much dark matter I expect to see when I integrate over my line of sight. And this is the particle physics. I have a theory and I can exactly predict these things. So this, there's a dimensionless version of this, which is called a J factor. You basically just normalize it to, you normalize away the absolute distance and distance scales in the problem. I'm not gonna bother defining it. That's just an astrophysicist convention. But the point is that this is something that I do n-body simulations, or I go to my rotation curves and get an estimate of how much dark matter I expect to be in a particular place. And this is something that I'm going to rely on the astrophysicists to do better than I know how to do, because I don't really know how to do line of sight integrals and account for, you know, effects of my calorimeter, all of this kind of thing. What I care about is I had this beautiful theory of dark matter. You know, what is its signature going to be? Now, one thing I did want to mention is that this is for dark matter annihilation. If I actually had dark matter as some very long-lived decaying particle, so it's an unstable particle but unstable on very, very long time scales, then instead of being proportional to rho squared, it would just be proportional to rho. So we would also see high-energy cosmic rays of energy m chi, but one way of disentangling annihilation from decay is that the dependence on the expected dark matter distribution is completely different. So I can not only use this to distinguish different cosmic ray, or you know, what final states my dark matter is annihilating to, but I can also just use it to figure out whether it's annihilating or decaying. We're going to focus on annihilation because that's the most common thing by far. Okay, so are there any questions about just the factors that go into this equation? Keeping in mind that I'm not going to ask you to integrate rho chi squared. So. All right. Okay, so let's consider the particular case of annihilation to gamma rays. So if we draw our diagram of chi bar chi to, question mark here. If I want this to be a standard model particle, there are a few different choices I can have. I can have quarks, leptons, gauge bosons, Higgs boson. So there's a long list of possible final states that I can do. And so these we sort of understand how you can annihilate through. So for instance, if I have chi chi bar annihilating through an axial vector, I can just directly have it coupled to, say, the standard model of quarks. or I can have a couple of the gauge bosons, or I can produce some combination of Higgs and gauge bosons. I can do all of these things. And we're going to focus in particular on photon final states. So why focus on photons? Well, one is the laziness factor where, I shouldn't say laziness, but simplicity factor, where I don't want to have to tell you about all of the complicated galactic and dynamics that change your cosmic rays, the charged particle cosmic rays. The other thing is that because all of these particles are charged, you always get photons too, okay? Because photons couple to anything that's electromagnetic. And so if I'm producing things that are electromagnetically charged, I also get photons, just at higher order in perturbation theory. And in fact, even though the photons are typically higher order in perturbation theory, you can often extract the best bounds from photons just because they don't have all of this, these other uncertainties that are bundled into them. Okay, so even though the rates are smaller, the bounds can be just as good or better for other things. So how do we get photons? Dark matter is, after all, dark. And so people often put all kinds of puns in their paper titles when they're talking about light and dark matter and all kinds of things. But this means that there's no renormalizable, I should say, coupling to photons. It's not actually charged itself, but it interacts with things that are charged, and those things interact with photons. So we can get two different kinds. I'll call them primary and secondary photon. Well, maybe I'll avoid the terminology. Maybe I'll use direct and continuum. So for direct photon production, what I have is I have my dark matter coming in. And then I'm going to produce two charged standard model particles. And then if I just say, okay, well, I have a standard model, a standard model bar, I can just close this loop and stick two photons on. Okay? So this gives me a process that's just chi chi bar to gamma gamma, even though chi does not actually interact with photons. Okay. Now, this, as I said, it's higher order in perturbation theory. I have an extra, extra factor of e squared. There's an extra factor of 16 pi squared from the loop. But what's nice about this is that if I just do a conservation of energy calculation, if this chi is moving very slowly, then you can see that e gamma is exactly equal to m chi. The spread in velocity is 10 to the minus 3. That's going to be some negligible correction to this. So if I look at what my direct photons look like, here's my F of E. I get a bump right at M chi. And this is great, because if I see a bump in photons and I just look at what the mass is, that tells me immediately what the mass of my dark matter particle is. This is way more information than my direct detection experiment was giving me. Okay. Now, the problem is it's a loop process, and so the rate for this is actually quite small. And until recently, this was considered the smoking gun of indirect detection. If you see this, there's absolutely nothing that can mimic this. Except, of course, a few years ago, there was evidence for a photon line in Fermi data at a mass, an energy of 130 GeV. And it's since been shown that that's mostly a systematic effect in their detector. It's a function of, at energies just below 130 GeV, their detector was worse at reconstructing them. And a little bit above, it was also worse. But right at 130, it was better. And so you sort of shaped the background to look like a bump. So it is the smoking gun, but I think it's a smoking gun minus a little bit now that we've seen something that looks like an extremely clear photon line, and it's turned out to be an instrumental effect. But at least it's something that was caught, right? So, but really, this is beautiful. If you just see a bump in a huge number of photons at a single energy, there's really nothing astrophysically at energies of 10 to thousands of GeV. There are no standard model particles that are created that would give rise to this kind of signature. So this is nice. but it's a low rate. And generally, you expect to see a line after you see other evidence. So this is sort of what I meant by you want to see evidence for dark matter in different spectral features of your energy. So the other thing that you can do is you can have a similar diagram where I have dark matter going to standard model bar. And if it's charged, I can just emit a photon. Now, this is also higher order in perturbation theory, but it's lower order in perturbation theory than this. And you also get an enhancement at low energies. I hope in your QFT course you saw that there's an infrared divergence in QED associated with soft photon emission. So you have a very large rates of enhancement of low energy photons, but of course, you can't really see low energy photons over the background because the backgrounds are also at low energy. So this is nice because you have a much larger rate, but you can't really see where most of your photons are coming from. And so what you end up for continuum photons is something that looks more like a falling spectrum. Okay, which eventually cuts off at the mass of the dark matter particle. So there's more photons to look for. But unlike this, there's no distinctive scale for this. This is sort of some featureless distribution. And so unlike here, where I could just be like, that's dark matter annihilating at this mass, this looks kind of like the shape that I would get from a background. So what you're looking for is just more than you expected. And so these two things are very complementary in that the kinds of uncertainties that affect them are very different. Okay. There's also another effect that you have to consider, which is the fact that these photons can also collide with just standard model particles lying around. And they can have their energy modified. So it's true that photons mostly come to us unscattered, but sometimes they scatter a little bit. Okay, and this will destroy your spectrum a little bit. Okay. Another thing that I should point out is that while this gives you a lot of photons, if you're annihilating to quarks, quarks don't actually exist in nature, as we spent a long time discussing. So these tend to, I should clarify that. Quarks exist in nature. They don't exist freely in nature. Okay. So this quark, when it gets a certain distance from other quarks, the strength of the strong interactions cause extra QQ bar pairs to pop out of the vacuum. And these bind up into what we call hadrons. So each quark turns into a spray of nuclei, so baryons, and also mesons, which are things like pions. Okay? And it turns out that in particular, the lightest pion, the lightest one, which is the pi zero, decays to two photons. So if I produce a quark, I produce pions, and then my pions decay to photons. So even without the emission of this extra gamma, I also get photons from pion decay. So really, annihilation to anything just produces a bunch of photons. Okay? And I can go and look for those photons. Okay. Let's see. Okay. So the problem is that astrophysical sources produce photons too. This is why we point our telescope in certain directions so that we can sort of maximize the amount of dark matter relative to the amount of photons. But their photons they look sort of like the continuum spectrum. And in fact, they're even lower energy than this. So the standard model things produce low, low energy photons. And so if I can go, if I go to higher energy photons, then my bounds get stronger. in terms of the number of actual photons I see. Okay, so bounds on phi got stronger. But we know that omega chi, which is equal to m chi times n chi, or this is rho chi, this is fixed by the CMB, by all the stuff we've been talking about. So if I go to higher energy photons, this is really secretly higher chi mass. So I expect my bounds to go up at higher chi mass. But what this is telling me is that m chi goes like 1 over n chi. So essentially, if my m chi gets bigger, my number density gets smaller. If there's a fixed amount of energy and there's more energy per particle, I just have fewer particles. So there's a trade-off. I want to go to higher energies, but then because my backgrounds are smaller. But then as I increase my energy too much, I just don't have enough dark matter to actually see. Because remember, this phi goes like n chi squared. So it's quadratically sensitive to this quantity. So if I increase my mass by an order of magnitude, my flux goes down by two orders of magnitude. So when I put these together, I actually find that the bounds on models are weaker at high mass. They're stronger at the low mass. Because even though I have these large backgrounds, I sort of win by the fact that I just have more n chi's. Okay, so the results I'm going to show you are from Fermilat, the Fermi Large Area Telescope. It's sensitive to E gamma in the range of 50 MeV to about 300 GeV. Then there are other experiments like HESS to pick up at 300 GeV and go to higher energies. It's on the International Space Station. I already talked a little bit about how it works, so I won't go into that. So the latest result, which is from dwarf spheroidals. They did not see any significant evidence of dark matter annihilation. So what we typically do is we normalize it to the thermal cross-section, which is 3 × 10⁻²⁶ centimeters cubed per second. So this is my cross-section in centimeters cubed per second. This is my m chi. 10, 100, 1,000. So this is 3 × 10⁻²⁶. Here's 10⁻², 10⁻². So I end up with something that looks kind of like this. And all of this region is excluded. So this is what I would naively expect if, because it's the exact same process that I get from that's determining my thermal relic abundance. So what this is suggesting is that if I want the cross-section associated with thermal relic abundance, I'm excluding things below about 10 GeV in mass. Then the higher ones, the prospects for this are improving, but they get weaker exactly for this reason that the flux gets smaller as the mass goes up. Okay. Now, this is under the assumption of some particular final state. So in particular, this is for annihilation to BD bar or just QQ bar in general. If you annihilate to leptons only, the bounds get weaker. And the reason is that quarks give you photons from neutral pions. Leptons don't. And so you just end up with fewer gamma rays. Now, what's a little bit interesting is that, so this is the 2-sigma exclusion. They expected to be able to exclude sort of this band. So if you just do the statistics, you think that you should be able to exclude up to about 100 GeV, but really they were only able to exclude up to about 10. So what this means, it could be a statistical fluctuation. There were more photons than they expected, and so they weren't able to set as strong a bound. If you believe in dark matter annihilation, then maybe you could see that this is a hint that we're actually observing this. An interesting sidebar to the story is we say, okay, well, the dwarfs are just one possibility. What about the galactic center? Fermi has not actually released any results for the galactic center. Right? We're still waiting for the dark matter results from the galactic center. And the reason is that in 2009, Dan Hooper and Lisa Goodenough did an analysis of early Fermi data. Now, what's nice about Fermi is they actually release all of their data publicly within about a few weeks of taking it. So anyone, including you, can go in and analyze their data. And they provide tools for analyzing the data. They observed an excess of gamma ray emission in the 500 MeV to few GeV energy range coming from the galactic center. Okay? And in the intervening time, there were several papers this year. Again, none of these were actually by Fermi. These are all from external physicists. Several analyses which show that the excess is still there, and it's reached a statistical significance of about 40 standard deviations. Okay. So this excess is there. There's no question about whether it's there or not. Now, the real question is what's actually causing this excess? And if I'm being really conservative, I would say, really, I don't understand what's going on in the galactic center. And there are some objects called millisecond pulsars that can give rise to an excess. They see sort of, if you subtract away what their expected backgrounds are, you see sort of a bump here. This is 500 MeV. This is, say, 5 to 10 GeV. Okay. So this is there. But of course, this whole analysis is predicated on the fact that I understand my backgrounds well enough to subtract them away and be left with a bump. So it's a very ongoing, active discussion at the moment of, do we trust these analyses? Is this excess a real thing? Is the fact that they should have been, I should say that this is consistent with dark matter of M chi is about 40 GeV. Okay, so they should have been able to exclude a 40 GeV WIMP at a thermal cross section. So this is at sigma v of about exactly the thermal value. So there's some sort of nice features of this, and they should have been able to exclude it in dwarfs, but they weren't. But I don't know, maybe they're just messing something up. So this is sort of interesting to keep your eye on, but I think it highlights some of the challenges of indirect detection, which are, we know how to set really good bounds if we don't see something, and then if we do see something, it's hard to know what to do with it. So in doing these analyses, they've shown that this looks like what you would get from dark matter. It comes from this spherically symmetric halo around the center of the galaxy. It seems to follow an NFW profile. It seems to go like the square of the NFW profile density. But I think we're a very, very long way from being able to conclusively say whether this is actually something that's beyond standard model astrophysics, or if there's just some really high energy astrophysical source in this energy range that we just didn't know was there, or that we didn't know was there in that particular quantity. So ideally, we would like to independently confirm this with other experiments. So as we talked about, there's a complementarity between direct detection and indirect detection. Unfortunately, it's easy to pick an interaction that gives me a large indirect detection cross-section and a velocity suppressed direct detection cross-section. So they're complementary in that what you see in one is hard to see in the other. And so that's good from the perspective of excluding models, because no model can really hide from all of them. But it's not good from the perspective of, if we see something in one, we want to check it in the other. That's suddenly very hard. And then just before we go, the last statement I want to make is that all of this is assuming that sigma v is essentially a constant today. Now, in last week's class and in the homework, we talked about how actually sigma v, you can do some non-relativistic expansion. So if a is equal to 0, then my sigma v goes like v squared, which has a 10 to the minus 6 suppression today. Okay. So depending on what my process is, if I have a is non-zero, then this bound applies of 10 GeV. If I don't, then there isn't any constraint from these. So just like direct detection, depending on my interaction, this can constrain dark matter or it cannot constrain dark matter. So it's very hard to kind of assemble all of the puzzle pieces together so that we cover all of the possibilities. Okay, are there any questions about the results or the last part? Okay, well, have a good long weekend, and I'll see you beginning.